NVM. And the proposal does not have to be specific to bus buffer. That's what I'm trying to say. Bus buffer is just one layer of these very different possible locations of deploying NVM. And they may or may not be called bus buffer. Based on what I heard, it sounds like even in the DOE community, there's different thoughts of how to, where to place bus buffer and how to use bus buffer. Right? So the proposal does not have to be so much type of bus buffer. You can look at a broader view of deep solid hierarchy.
Right.
Lawrence Livermore has had several machines over the last few years that have had different configurations of SSDs, including them in one per node, and they've run production software tests using that environment, and all of the applications people have said to them, the last thing we want to do is use this as fast disk. We have all sorts of other things we want to do with them. So that was even more strength for the argument that we need these to be slow memory rather than fast disk, and trying to figure out where to put them and how much to get the best throughput through the machine. Based on what Ming had put together originally, I looked at that and I said, well, pretty well hit all of the different pieces. We just need to combine that all together, and then we can have a way for people to try to figure out how to size these different non-volatile memory resources across the or hierarchy for the best throughput based on their workloads.
I actually have a question about the depth of the storage hierarchy. Does this are we talking about is there gradation within the non-volatile memories? Like, would we see for example, MLC flash deployed in some areas and SLC flash deployed in lower quantities, but for better performance, or even different types of like NAND versus NOR, or is it that it's just a matter of the placement of SSD type memory, and it's all going to look more or less the same from a performance profile standpoint?
Oh, I expect it to look, in some cases, even radically different. For the on-the-memory bus, you need something that has probably at least read performance that's on the order of DRAM. Write performance may be slower, but you probably want read performance on that order. And for the other places, it depends on what technology is available. I don't really want to limit this to thinking about just SSDs, since the intent from this is to be usable in like the 2025 kind of time frame for a new machine. And by that point, the projection is we should have some of these alternative technologies available. We want to be able to have something that's general enough that we can take the characteristics of that other technology and be able to use the things we've learned in this project to be able to help guide selection on that front as well.
All right. Great.
In the report, I think one place in the report mentioned there might be 10 different kinds of NVM technologies.
Right.
So we can assume that in this third hierarchy, the NVM technologies will be heterogeneous. But exactly what they are, I guess we do not have to. I don't think the industry has entirely figured that out yet. We do not have to make that reason to
be. Sure.
Right. And the performance characteristics of using an SSD to do a fast array dimension of reordering is very different than using, say, DRAM, just because of the granularity of access. And so those are the kinds of things that we want to be able to look at from an operational standpoint and figure out these are the characteristics that we need, and that way we can plug in different performance characteristics and have some reasonable measure come out.
Any other thoughts about the overview?
I think it's great, but this looks like most of our two pages right here in our overview. So I think it lays out, I think for a full proposal, it actually lays out all the sections really well of everything. I really like how it comes together. So I'm in favor, but it's a matter of cranking this down.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
Okay. So then maybe we can go ahead and talk about each individual task. Raju, can you start with the first one?
Yeah, sure. So this first one is about building new application interfaces and data abstractions. And this new interface can be used not just for allocating data structures, but also for checkpointing these data structures. And for those who are not aware of some of the previous work we did on software persistent memory, this is somewhat of a departure from what DOE conventionally does with the data formats, which are mostly self-describing. This is an entirely non-self-describing data abstraction where the application allocates just bytes of memory, and the meaning of the memory is defined by the application. And what we do in this library software is that data that is reachable from some root structure gets discovered and becomes part of the state of the application, right? And that that state of the application can now be, you know, checkpointed. It can be versioned, potentially branched into alternate timelines and either for further analysis or simultaneous simulation and those kind of stuff. So this is the basic abstraction that that we created at some point in time for a previous project. But all of that was based on block-based storage. And the proposal here is to actually use node local persistent or NVRAM or any kind of flash that's available to enable the same abstraction. So since Jay is here, I would actually want to ask him, I've talked about this work with Gary as well as John Bent and a few other people, and they seem to like the abstraction. But when I was reading the document, in one of those places, they do talk about the importance of self-describing data formats. I want to get a sense from you for what you think, you know, something like a container that is defined entirely by the application, how relevant that would be for future applications in HPC.
It depends on where it's being used. If it's being used for workflows or as checkpoint restart, I don't think it's a problem at all. If you're trying to push something out for offline analysis later, then it becomes an issue.
Right.
Because there's also a big push towards doing key value stores. Mm-hmm. And this is another way to kind of look at doing a key value store, because there's no additional data self-describing in that. You just have a block.
Right.
So it's just a matter of where it goes in the stack, rather than assuming it can go all the way to permanent archive.
Right. So the offline analysis piece, I think I agree it's more difficult. But one of the points I was thinking about making in this piece is that you could potentially use these data containers even for offline analysis, as long as the offline analysis software is able to make sense of the data. Right, and then of course there are issues with type compatibility across different kinds of machines. But assuming that can be worked out, you could potentially even support offline analysis with sort of non-self-describing data, as long as the application that's doing the analysis is able to make sense of the data.
So, Raju, I thought the containers have their metadata stored somewhere.
Yeah, but they're not self-describing. For instance,
definitely. And the other thing is you might, even though it's not a self-describing format, but you may predefine the format ahead of time. And just know that when I read from this buffer, this is the format it's going to be. It doesn't have to be discoverable necessarily.
Right. So, for instance, if you're running a C program, and one of the things that the self-describing format helps with is that you can, you know, then the data container becomes language independent, right?
Right.
And the architecture independent potentially. So you can write writers and readers for those data formats, such as NetCDF or HDF5. But if you have an abstract non-describing format, then you get tied to the language. But then, you know, if you're doing some kind of simulation software and analysis connected to it, that becomes a restriction that you need to use a similar language or a similar type of architecture to do the analysis as the original simulator, right? The key thing is that do we get advantages of having non-self-describing formats the way we are talking about? And I think that's the key. What are the advantages? Why would you give up a self-describing format in the first place?
Limited capacity.
Right.
I mean, that's the big thing we're going to be dealing with the non-volatile memory is we have limited capacity. So right. I think there's an easy, strong argument for it.
Okay, that's good. Yeah.
Because if you're giving up 10% of your storage space for metadata that you could infer or discover through other means, that's a lot when you have a very limited amount of a resource.
Yeah, great point. Okay. It helps a lot. And and the other thing is, of course, you can completely avoid data manipulation, serialization, and things of that kind, because you could, you know, write out your memory as is. So that's I see that also as an advantage. So that's where I'm going with the first piece, and then I, you know, with respect to the scalable checkpointing idea, I think that's the state of the art as far as I can make out, right? The scalable checkpointing where you have different granularities or maybe different frequencies of checkpointing happening at different levels in the memory hierarchy. And I think that it would be important to be able to support that also with this new abstraction for both data as well as checkpoints.
And that's good. Yeah. If you flash it out, I think it also connects to the next piece that he is gonna work on. Regarding data movement.
Okay, that's...
So going back to the previous discussion, I guess if you can somehow cover your base saying that you can, for offline analysis, you can use application knowledge to converge the containers to self-describing formats.
Actually, that's a good... Yeah, that's... Right. Yeah, that's a good point, right? You can write converters that understand this non-describing container into a self-describing container.
I have another question. Is that you emphasize non-POSIX implementations? I guess we must have strong. We also just like use data containers. We didn't have a good reason to not be POSIX compatible.
Right. Exactly. So. I think the POSIX compliant mechanisms have one major drawback is that they are non-transactional. And because they are non-transactional, you cannot rely on any transactional capabilities from inside the operating system. So what I'm going to be proposing is that inside the operating system, if you can build transactional capabilities, then and you actually utilize those transactional capabilities, then you can simplify checkpointing at the application library level.
Does this make sense to you, Jay?
I'm sorry, say that again.
What you just said, does it make sense to you? Would it be a complete showstopper if we advocate for non-POSIX?
Advocate for
non-POSIX API.
Oh, no, I think that's fully expected that we'll advocate for non-POSIX APLs.
But
there's a pretty wide agreement that POSIX is something that needs to go away.
Yeah.
Nobody quite knows what to replace it with, because we know that object stores are not going to be sufficient for the archive level or even the disk-based scratch, but the serialization through the metadata server is the part that just has to end. So trying to figure out a way to break that requirement is really what we're all hoping for. And we just need to find a way to get the applications to still work with it, and that's probably a small increment rather than a large one.
Yeah.
Can you elaborate on the limitation that you see on POSIX that might be useful for larger?
I'm sorry, Ming, could you rephrase that again?
Sorry. So I'm asking Jay, he said that it's a, looks like the people agree that POSIX need to go away. I'm just asking Jay to elaborate on this. Maybe provide some arguments for your write-up.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's been in casual conversation for the last several years, but I don't know that I've seen anything actually published on it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the way I'm selling non-POSIX here is that because of the current POSIX interface, which is, for instance, for storage, it's non-transactional, you have to do a lot more heavy lifting inside at the application level to make checkpoints consistent and things like that. Yeah. But if you had a transactional POSIX, well, non-POSIX, then the application level creation and manipulation of checkpoints could become much more efficient. Assuming that your non-POSIX implementation is inside the OS is efficient in the first place. Right, so that's where I'm going with this. We've done some work, unpublished, and it's quite promising, and that's what I'm building upon for this piece.
Yeah, I think it's very viable.
So maybe you can move on to the second task. Jay, you want to can you explain it a little bit?
Yeah, give me 1 second here. Okay. The purpose on this task, this energy efficient data staging and movement across layers of the storage hierarchy. We've really run into the problem that we can't get all of the, this really motivates why we want the in-compute area and non-volatile memory, is so that we can move stuff out of the current address space or even the node someplace else so that somebody else can pick up on it and do processing. If it's all doing in-situ processing, we end up having to have the analysis be able to scale the same as the application. And we have had instances where that just doesn't work at all. And we also want to be able to potentially have multiple consumers for the data, and that also makes it a little more difficult. So if we can take the data and move it out of the current address space and move it to a different place, then we have the ability to have somebody else pick it up in a disconnected way. The Hobbs work is looking at how do we split a physical node so that we can run the analysis and the simulation on the same node together and then use shared memory. But another part of that is so that we can split that apart using the same interfaces and have it appear to the analysis and the simulation as if it's still on the same node. And it's just that it will end up doing the data transmission between them. The D2T pieces, that was a project I did a couple of years ago that was looking at the difficulty of having a parallel M by N data movement between a producer and a consumer. And the issue was that we don't know when that data movement is complete or correct, so we need to have some way to bracket that operation so that the consumer will only pick up on the data when they know it's a viable, complete data set for them to process. So that was the D2T system, was a low overhead way of bracketing those kinds of operations, both for data movement or other sorts of things like a system reconfiguration.
I know that last time when Greg was here at your place, he worked on something to reducing the amount of data being moved.
Yeah,
you think that might be maybe relevant here?
Definitely. That's really the ultimate goal is that we don't want to move data any more than we have to.
Mm-hmm.
In cases where the communication intensity for doing the data analysis is high, we absolutely want to move it. For places where it's just a compute intensive task, then you want to spread it out as much as possible. I mean, that's fairly obvious, but we want to be able to have a system that's flexible enough to do both.
Okay. Yeah. I know you recently have a couple of papers on related to data.
Yes.
And movement.
Yeah.
Any question about the second task?
So I think, I mean, let me see if I understand this correctly. So Jay, you're proposing that if you have multiple applications in some sort of a daisy chain where one application is generating the data, the other application is munching on the data, then you need to have an efficient way of moving the data to where the application is, needs it, or something like that? Is that fair characterization?
That's part of it. It's more a matter of you want to be able to match the data movement with the consumption. So if the data doesn't have to move off node, but we need to get it out of RAM because we don't have enough RAM available, then we'll need to use node local storage.
Mm.
If it's a big, ugly second task down for the consumer, we're probably going to want to move it off node to different storage. And it may be a matter of the way that the application is set up is that it could work in either way and that we're going to initially write it to the local storage and then we need to be able to migrate it to the other. Or we may need to migrate it down to some storage that's visible to another platform, depending on if the analysis is running there or not. So we want to be able to pick and choose and have things move to the right place.
Right. Yeah. So this I'm just trying to understand the piece of software that would where it would live that would allow this sort of data movement, and what kind of software that would be. It's just that in the work in the software stack, I'm not able to pinpoint where such software would reside, or I don't know if I'm asking the right question or not.
Primarily middleware.
Okay.
For example, put it in the Adios library and have it be able to give in some additional data annotation that it gets as input. When data gets written out, it knows, oh, I need to push it to this location and trigger these other operations once I'm done so that the consumer knows it can pick it up, for example. Or it might be a matter of extending the storage hierarchy or the software that manages the service that manages the in-compute area storage so that it can migrate things based off of usage. It's one of the things that we're going to get on Trinity is this, we call it hierarchical I.O. or something. An H.I.O. is the name of it. And the intent is to be able to be this software service management layer for all of the in-compute area storage that will do the allocation, it will do automatic data draining to storage once your job ends and those kinds of things. And I was thinking of building on that kind of an idea, but focus it more strongly on the workflow side of things rather than the draining to file system kind of things.
So
if I may, I guess what Jay's proposing is some sort of IO middleware that can decide what data to move and where to move it to, so that we can optimize the load on the storage system and for the performance of the application.
Well, and also the load on the network.
The load on the network, yes, of course.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, I think I sort of understand it, though not completely, but yeah, we should move on.
Yeah, you're not the only one.
So after we have more,
we'll have to refine this more and make it more clear.
Yeah. So the third one is on patch management. Roger, we can start that. I can have a little bit about the things I do.
Right. So there are a couple of things going on here. One is, well, assuming you have node local storage of some form, and you want to use this node local storage as a cache, either as a read cache or a write buffer to store checkpoints, for instance, or both, right? Because you have in-transit applications that are doing analysis on data that is generated, in-situ applications that are also doing analysis on potentially checkpoints that are a few versions old. Using these node local storage as caches makes a lot of sense in those usages. The key thing to however realize is that these node local storages are when they're used as caches, these caches are what I call end up being non-data path caches. And this is some joint work that Jason and I are doing. It's building on some joint work that Jason and I are doing. And these non-data path caches have some unique properties. For instance, since you are not forced to put a data item when it is accessed into such a cache, you can choose not to put a data item in the cache, whereas conventional caching algorithms or caches always insert on a miss, right? So some of the initial findings that we've had in this space is that you need new techniques to best use non-data path caches. That are aware of this flexibility to not insert. And you can not just reduce the write rate, which becomes critical for caches that are built out of flash or even other kinds of non-volatile memory when you choose not to insert unimportant items. But it also turns out that you know, when you insert something that is less important than stuff that's already in the cache, you may end up evicting something more important and therefore reduce the hit rate. So even from a hit rate standpoint, you might benefit by considering non-data path caches more carefully. So that's sort of the direction that I'm going with the first piece. And then, when you have persistent memory, where let's say you want to use the persistent memory as a cache for your file system data, right? And the file system data, the file system is, of course, the permanent store for the file system could be remote, either on a PFS or a parallel file system, or maybe organized into a hierarchy at the burst buffer layer, wherever that might reside. But still, you know, when you start accessing these files, they get cached locally inside the node. One of the problems here when you're using byte addressable NVRAM like devices is this impedance mismatch, because file systems export blocks, whereas persistent memories can be written and read from at the granularity of bytes. So when you start writing into these caches that you build out of NVRAM, then you run into is read before write requirements. And some of the work that we've done recently actually showed that you can completely avoid that impedance mismatch using, you know, some additional metadata for keeping track of what gets modified at smaller granularity. So that the second piece helps with writes. The first piece helps with reads primarily, and maybe even writes. But the core idea is that you have caches that are either byte addressable now, and therefore need to be managed at smaller granularities, or you have caches that are not in the data path, and therefore you need to rethink your cache replacement algorithms. So that's sort of the direction for this piece. Now, of course, the HPC specific piece here is a little less obvious, which was one of the concerns for me as I was writing. But I believe that, you know, just because something applies to non-HPC doesn't mean that it's not important for HPC. And that's kind of the rationale I came up with. But it would be nice to hear, you know, feedback from someone who's more closely involved with HPC.
Well, this is Jay. Yeah. I can talk to this a little bit, because this is something we've also been looking at recently, is if we're doing a job that ends up wanting to push data to a particular layout and location for an analysis, and the data is really much bigger than we want to have to stream out to disk and then pull up back in, if somebody else is doing a read of something they only need once, it is much better for the entire overall system performance if that is not cached for them. So having an ability just to say cache, don't cache for data would be a real improvement in our ability to manage these limited resources.
In this, I know you have some papers on caching too, Jay. Those papers, or this is more recent?
No, this is, again, this is discussions for futures.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that, you know, having a scenario like that laid out a little bit more. The use case, the HPC use case for something like this, I think that would make the proposal stronger. And so Jay, I will probably bother you to get more detail about what you just said.
Okay. Yeah. That one of the other proposals I'm on has a strong focus in that area for the entire proposal. So if there is related to work, I'm sure we'll dig it up.
Okay. That's great.
So Roger, while you're describing your idea, you mentioned only no local NVM. Can you expand your idea to also support the NVM at the other places? For example, we may have NVM on IOTA, and you can also use them for caching buffers.
Yeah, absolutely. I think this is not specific. One piece is probably the writes are specific to the node local. But the non-data path caches are apply pretty much everywhere in the hierarchy.
So after Roger's paragraph, I did a couple of paragraphs, basically focusing on the endurance issue. So crash memories are known to have serious problems, futuristic NVM technology likely to also have wear out issues. So if we don't use this NVM carefully, then they can quickly wear out, and that can cause a lot of problems. So recently I did some work on cache deduplication, basically integrating deduplication with cache management and optimizing them based on performance and the endurance objective. So basically what my write-up is about how to expand that idea to support, but I suppose, HPC workloads. On one hand, we use the NVM tools to buffer checkpoints. If every time the application checkpoints, all the data structures and store them in carry on the NVM. And when this happens frequently, because the application has a periodic checkpoint, then we can quickly react to the NVM, the memory cells. So we have to be smart about it. We have to, that's one thing. And on the other hand, not only those firefighter rights calls, but also the read that we want to stage in the NVM for example, for in-transit processing, they also cause wear out because they have to be written to the NVMs. So basically, the work I did before is to use deduplication to address this problem, having it seems to have the integrated as part of the patch module. So I'm planning to expand upon that idea. Yeah, because I put it here mainly because I feel that this is really important problem. When we really start to have NVMs in production, HPC data centers, I think if we don't address this problem, they're gonna cost payback. Yeah. So what do you think, Jay?
No, I think it's a really fundamental thing for dealing with the write endurance problem. I think it's a really solid idea to propose.
Raju, do you have any comments?
I agree. I think deduplication makes a lot of sense in this space and should certainly be exploited.
Hello? Raju?
Sorry, I was on mute. I just repeat what I said. I think that deduplication makes a lot of sense for these caches. The only question I had when I was reading this is that the potential for deduplication. When you have virtual machines, it's somehow, you know, it's more easily sellable but for these kinds of data, one of the questions I would have, for instance, is how much duplication does occur? And at what granularity? But in general, I think going after deduplication makes sense in pretty much any caching scenario. But it would be good to think about that the question, which is how much duplication is there for HPC? I know there is one paper that was published at FAST this year or the last year, which looked at I think the Darshan tool, but I don't know if they had any data about duplication. Maybe they did, so that might be something to look at.
Well, Ming's student and I did that last summer, actually. We looked at that and found that between 40 and 70% of the data did not change on a per output basis in two different classes of simulations.
So this is duplicate data or within the same checkpoint or something like that, maybe I don't understand the context. So you're saying that this is...
Sorry, it's broken up here. It was between checkpoints. It was between checkpoints.
Is this from the same application?
It was from the same application. It was between two different output steps, between 40 and 70% of the data did not change between the two different output steps, depending on the simulation and the maturity of the run.
And this simulation, that's a full checkpoint, not incremental checkpoint.
Well, it's what they would normally do. They would normally do a full. They wouldn't an incremental kind of thing. And it was molecular dynamics with LAMPS, and the other one was a finite element code.
Actually,
those are two fairly big areas.
Yeah, I think in that context, deduplication makes perfect sense. I mean, especially if you're using your node local flash or even the burst buffer for storing a bunch of recent checkpoints. It makes a lot of sense. Yeah, that's great.
Would there be any opportunity across different applications, Jeff?
Doubtful.
Okay. I think this reminds me. So I have another comment for Raju is regarding the consistency in the cache management. You mentioned the only cache system, parallel system. I think maybe you can also expand on that because with this deep storage hierarchy, there may be different versions of checkpoint different stored at different layers. And so the consistency is also required to make sure that every layer is a consistent checkpoint. Not just at the file system,
The one bit of guidance that I've gotten on this call is to be careful about proposing replicated data in any form. That having some resilience mechanisms is good, but saying we're going to store two or three copies is something that would have a harder time getting accepted.
Right. Thanks. What I was saying is just because the by nature the data is moved along the pipeline across the layer of hierarchy. So we may have a more recent version of checkpoint at NVM that's closer to the compute area, but have an older version of the checkpoint that is the NVM that is farther from the compute area. And then we have another version that is even older that is slowed down the parallel system. So I'm suggesting that Roger's idea on ensuring consistency can be applied on all these layers, not just on parallel system.
Okay, yeah, that makes sense.
Does it make sense to you, Raju?
I think so, although I don't completely understand what you mean when you say apply consistency at various layers. I mean, do you mean that a single checkpoint is split across multiple layers? And
So earlier you were talking about that, depending on the consistency of the checkpoint, make sure that the checkpoint is consistently stored on the parallel system.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
So in the face of failure is what I meant, right? So for instance, you're writing out a checkpoint and let's say in the middle of the process or somehow stuff that you wrote out got lost and then your node goes away and you still need a checkpoint that's consistent at the next level. How do you ensure that? That's really what I was talking about.
Got it. So what I'm saying is that the next level does not have to be the parallel system. It can be intermediate NVM layer.
Right. Yeah. Absolutely, yes. Yeah, so in that sense, I think I understand now what you meant.
Okay.
Yes.
So no other question, let's move on. So the number four is the IO scheduling that matches. So the main idea is that mentions about the basically multi-application, multi-user environment that if you envision the future HPC systems will be. So there will be multiple different kind of applications. And we know there will be simulations, data analytics, and example overflows, and they will be sharing the they'll be sharing the storage hierarchy. Actually, they may be sharing every individual layer of the storage hierarchy. So, and they may have different performance requirements. So you can imagine the checkpoint request bandwidth throughput, the initialization request latency. So we need to have IO scheduling layer, maybe as part of the IO middleware that does the scheduling to differentiate the different IOs and satisfy the performance requirements. So that's basically what I'm talking about. It will be built upon my earlier work on parallel system IO scheduling. And more recently, I'm also working on the flash storage IO scheduling. So those will be the foundation of this proposed work.
Have you seen the work from Matteo Dorier? He was at INRIA and he's now at Argonne.
No.
The other one is Sagar Thapalia. He's at University of Alabama, Birmingham. I work with Sagar, so I know his work really well. He did a paper called IOCOP that was trying to do so that he was doing scheduling. And then Matteo Dorier's work for his thesis was essentially the other variations on the project. So between the two of them, they covered the entire space. Argonne kind of has this project going already. So I'm not sure how to get a strong foothold here.
Can you follow me? Can you send me some pointers? I'd like to take a look at those. I'll try to find out some differentiators.
Right. So, Bing, since you talk about QoS here, I actually considered putting some QoS at the cache level based on some of the recent work that we've done on
this. Yes, yes.
And I don't know if that, and I mean, one of the things that Jay said earlier makes me think that it might actually be quite relevant, which is if you have, let's say, a burst buffer that is shared across a whole bunch of different applications as a cache, right? Because this burst buffer is used not just for storing checkpoints, but also for caching various things that applications need, then you need some mechanism to figure out how to share this cache, or, you know, how much of the cache to allocate to various applications. Right, and so I'm just wondering if that is something we want to bring in or not. Because that would potentially address some of the QoS-related requirements for these applications.
So I guess the question is, should we assume that this NVM cache will be oversubscribed?
Well, if a cache is undersubscribed, it's not being utilized well enough, right? So caches tend to be oversubscribed.
But my impression is in the HPC environment, while the particular NVM node will be, if it's offload NVM, it will be dedicated to a particular rack of compute node, which will be dedicated to a particular application.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not sure.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I see now. I was referring to the shared burst buffer for the entire cluster, right? For the whole supercomputer, which is presumably running a bunch of different applications.
But even the I/O load is dedicated to a particular slice of computer.
Right, but these are this, you know, earlier Jay was talking about this not in the I/O path, the burst buffers that are not in the I/O path at all, so they become independent. Maybe I misunderstood what he was saying, but it sounded to me as if he was proposing burst buffers that are outside any I/O or compute or file server node, and still accessible from the compute nodes or the I/O nodes or even the file server nodes. And then the question is, how do you allocate space on this burst buffer, which is, I'm assuming, is large, but still smaller than your actual file system storage space, right? And that's the kind of question I was thinking about. And that might help to address some of the QoS-related issues. It doesn't provide end-to-end QoS, but it provides an additional knob for QoS.
Yeah, and that may be the way to get an angle in on this, since you're looking at potentially bypassing layers or doing other sorts of operations on it. That may be the right way to wedge in on this.
But will a particular, NVM node have the checkpoints from different simulation applications?
Might be more than one. In fact, it's probably more than one just from a performance standpoint.
Mm. Right, but Ming, I was referring to a burst buffer. You know, beefy burst buffer that is not connected to any compute node or any I/O node. And okay. I just wanted to check with Jay. Is that what he was referring to earlier?
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
So
if you have such a, you know, burst buffer, basically a cache or something that can store checkpoints or other things that applications need, And then you have the problem of, well, how do you allocate space on that beefy, high-performing caching layer, right? Or
yeah.
Buffering layer.
I was under the impression that this bus buffer node is a pre-write. So I thought it was dedicated to the compute nodes on that, right?
No, they're shared across the entire machine.
Okay. All right, that's good. Okay. Yeah, so then that sounds good. Yeah, we can there's a connection between the cache QoS and the IO scheduler here. Yeah.
Right. So the technique there which we've used for enterprise is MRC based allocation.
Mm.
Right. So you
right,
have
right, yeah.
workload miss ratio curves, and based on what miss ratio you're targeting, which might corresponding to a specific latency target, you make your allocations accordingly. But that's just one of the objectives, which is, latency targets for various applications or miss ratio targets for various applications. What I'm curious about is what would be a reasonable target for an HPC application for individual IO requests.
But there's a key difference case that for enterprise workload, we are exploiting the locality within the workload. Here, the data reuse happens across applications or the composite applications.
Yeah.
Right, so we want to use the checkpoint data from one application for a visualization application. So there's some differences here.
Yeah, that's true. I think that makes it an interesting and very different problem.
Yeah,
I agree.
Okay,
so that might be something to think about adding to this, either number 4 or maybe number 3, I don't know.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. I mean, I do not intend to have all these 8 task sizes, individual sections of proposal. We need to reorganize them suddenly. So for the sake of time, maybe we move on, because we still have a few more to go through. So the fifth one is JSON. JSON, can you talk about your thoughts?
Right. So first of all, I apologize for not actually adding the paragraphs to the document. As a matter of fact, I was reading the report that you put down there, and I was looking at these IO management, resource management. I think it's actually way out of my expertise, and I don't pretend that I could actually be able to put out anything new in this area. So I wanted to sort of talk to you actually during the day, but I was sidetracked.
Okay.
First of all, that I thought about several other potential maybe tasks that I could actually be able to contribute. But if none of them, because this is a little bit way out of my area, but if this is actually doesn't seem to be anything actually contributing to the value, feel free to not adding me to this project. So I was thinking about several things. First of all, we're talking about scientific applications. We're talking about HPC applications. I could do something, but because this is a project I had with the Los Alamos, basically doing the software, hardware, co-design modeling. And I was doing some work actually related to characterizing or trying to sort of figure out the skeleton for large scale scientific applications, the molecular dynamics and some of the science code. And this might be related to some kind of workload analysis or characterization that actually providing input to the IO system that you guys propose here. The other one is on some of the caching work that worked on with the with Raju, but since Raju is here, actually, I don't think that's actually I'm adding a lot of unique value here. And I could do some analytical framework modeling simulation, but the value of that is actually subjected to your view and see whether that actually a valuable input or not. So so that's basically what I have here. You're not the one to decide it, as I said earlier, that it's really okay for if you think that's actually I'm not really making much of a contribution, it's really okay that I'm not involving this project. It's interesting, but I'd rather have some valuable contributions.
I thought you did work on SDNs before.
Right, but this is something I was reading. It is more of sort of an IO, the document that you provided there is actually talking about a lot of them related to the RMA and the remote memory operations, atomic operations, and so on and so forth. Those interface designs. And I did some modeling for interconnection network and for HPC, but that's not really down to the layer that I think would be actually valuable to the overall design here, to really sort of stretch out as a potential sort of independent task. I have some reservation there. Yeah.
I understand. Yeah. So let's try to find out what we can work on together. My original thoughts is because if we want to provide end-to-end QNS and the statistics can report also talk about the need for correlation between L management and other type of resource management. My original thoughts is to have you to take care of the network management piece, right? So have a network expert who knows about the SDN or some network management, some extent, and that they can contribute to how to coordinate the network management with the management and the individual layers of this star hierarchy.
Yeah, right. I mean, I understand that the starting point, but if you look into the details of the particular actuary research questions that you're trying to answer, I think it's actually there's a disconnect in the sense that it's more than just having a SDN to provision the network according. There's a lot of things that actual lower level design, quality service, and so on and so forth. This is the area I'm actually never actually stepped myself into. So I think that I don't want to propose something that's eventually looks so naive.
Well, they do talk about the throttling, talk about the network throttling in the report as a mechanism for providing network service. So regarding this, I do have a question for Jay. What is the DOE's perspective about SDN, about employing SDN technologies in HPC? Hello, Jay.
The quality of service for the network?
Yes, yeah. So this software defined network.
I have not heard anything one way or the other. That's not really my area. I can ask around, though, and find out for sure.
Okay. So, because SDN, I had this conversation with Roger before. So it's mostly an enterprise technology for providing network QoS in enterprise computing environments.
Yeah.
I imagine it would be useful for the external network in HPC, not for the computer area network, but for the network that connects the computer area and the storage area.
The Ares network on the new Cray machines, that or the Dragonfly or whatever they're calling it,
That does do dynamic routing around traffic congestion. So that's one, I know one aspect of software-defined networking.
That, is that for the storage network or is it for the compute network?
For the compute network.
For the compute network, yeah. I know the compute network has a lot of advanced features. But
right.
My impression is that this external network that we have in the picture is more commodity technology, right? Maybe something like Ethernet and ground blue drive.
Right, or InfiniBand generally, but yeah.
InfiniBand, okay.
Yeah. It's just that the storage devices are so relatively slow that it doesn't make sense to spend a lot of money on it.
Right. Yeah. So I think the things that Jason suggests would be all used, I think they are all valuable. Yeah. So I think our hands are tied in a sense, only because the proposal does not, the solicitation does not allow us to address more than one thing. But I believe we can still use the workload characterization and the system modeling of things that Jason proposed, at least for evaluating the SSIO research that we are going to propose here. What do you guys think? I mean, Roger, what are your thoughts?
I think in the worst case,
if we cannot include any research component from Jason, we can include him as a city investigator. That's just what I'm thinking
in terms of
the worst case. Roger, please.
Yeah, sorry, I don't have any specific recommendations, actually, except to say that given that the proposal requires us to address one theme, if we start stepping on another theme, I don't know if it's going to be positively or negatively viewed. I just don't know. And I would err on the side of caution, just because there is an explicit language in the call for proposals, and not step on the other theme. That would be my initial reaction. But unfortunately, besides pointing out flaws in your in what you're saying, I don't have any constructive proposal. Unfortunately, I don't. I thought that my initial reaction for the SDN piece, which I told you also earlier, Ming, was that SDN, I feel, is still like a stronghold of the enterprise.
Yeah.
And I don't see it in the HPC. I haven't seen it in any paper that I've read. And I'm not saying that I've read all the papers on HPC out there, but it's just my sense that
I agree. So we can scratch off as research cards. We can just talk about how to use existing mechanisms for controlling network. For example, the existing feature side of InfiniBand, how to use it and coordinate it with the IO management. So we don't have to include that as independent as a specific research card. So I know Jason, that do you how familiar are you with the hyperbolic network? I mean, not hyperbolic network. I'm talking about the InfiniBand, this kind of network. How to manage it? How to model it? Things like that. So
actually, almost none at all. And I did some interconnection network. One of my students currently working at the Los Alamos, working for modeling the interconnect for this big machine, basically dealing with routing, queuing, and modeling issues. But I think that's probably not anything that we can actually propose. It's just a matter of modeling aspect. So. I think Raju's point is valid in the sense that, we we don't want to step onto something that is potentially harm the proposal. On the other hand, I think it's reasonable to sort of not include the piece that we are not really proposing anything. So you can mention, as you said, you mentioned that you're using Interconnection Network, but if there is nothing there, better not to actually include anything like that. And for me, and I think it's safe to sort of not include me at this point. And at some later point, if there is there's something that needs to do on the application side or on the caching side, specifically for modeling or analytics, that would be happy to help you.
What about trying to schedule the I/O around the other interconnect traffic, just so that you have a dual priority or even a multi-priority networking management to make sure that storage stays out of the way of the core computations communication? I don't know that is a better fit for this, but I know that that's certainly a more storage-oriented view on things.
Right. I guess in that aspect, I need to take a look at the existing work.
Right.
Just trying to be careful.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Okay, so Jason, please think about it a little bit more, and let's see whether we can find anything. So I guess there's three possibilities. One is that maybe based on Jay's suggestion, we can find something that we can propose some research. The second is, like I suggested, we can, even if we cannot include any research specific on network, we can include you as a senior investigator, as a person who is expert on networking and simulation modeling, so that we can use your expertise to help us answer the questions that we may encounter during our SSIO research. We can use your expertise in workload, the understanding of workloads and the network to help us prototype and evaluate our implementation. And third possibility is, of course, the worst of worst case is that then we can just not include you this time, but the next time, there's a different opportunity than what we're doing. It's your call, okay, Jason?
Okay.
The only constraint is that we have to make up our mind before Thursday. Once we submit the pre-application, we cannot change the team.
Right.
I guess we can drop, but we cannot add.
Right. Yeah.
Okay. So the sixth component is the parents. Kevin, can you say a little bit about it?
Sure. So let me just sort of say in general that security in the HPC world seems to be a very different animal than what we sort of see in the desktop and enterprise. Looking at the results from the workshop, this notion that security is implemented in trusted software running in the kernel on clients with a bunch of trusted servers, it sounds as though the trusted computing base is pretty much everything. So having anything working security-wise seems like it's a victory. Although I noted that one of the challenges that is considered here is the notion of potentially relaxing security enforcement away from the nodes or network hardware. There must be ways of preventing information leakage when without reliance on the kernel for enforcement. So that's that's a bit of a different view of security than the one that I've generally been advocating, which is about how do you ensure that data is trustworthy from the time of its generation to all the way through its processing. So I'm sort of coming at things perhaps, if anybody is sort of better tuned into what the needs are or how security is handled, if at all, in HPC environments, that would be interesting to know. So it sounds as though So my take is, you know, the general direction, well, unfortunately, Providence isn't allowed to be part of this, because I think Providence would be a great thing to have in these types of systems. But in the absence of those, it seems like the most important thing is viewing security as essentially a, understanding what the threat model is in these environments. If your threat model is that random bits of malware can get into your machine, then I think you need stronger guarantees than I think anybody in the HPC community is willing to pay the performance penalty to get. If it is just ensuring that data is reliable and that's perhaps a different story. So, an actively malicious adversary in an HPC environment, I think there are things you can do, borrowing from sort of the Byzantine, considering a Byzantine adversary and defending against those, but you're going to lose out on performance, which seems paramount in this space. So what I think is probably the most important thing is to ensure that security mechanisms that are put into place are actually tuned to the workloads that are being expected in terms of both the structure of data, the nature of where data is placed in these architectures, and so on. So I've done some work in the past considering using security as the basis for, using storage as the basis as somewhere where security policy can be defined for a system, because everything essentially, ultimately, anything that you're interested in eventually is going to make it to storage. So I've thought about this idea of how can we better leverage elements of the storage architecture. And so this idea of being able to of having multi-layer high-speed flash or non-volatile memory is interesting, because it allows us to do things like deal with data integrity. So you can have encryption that doesn't that is length preserving, that doesn't expand where the ciphertext doesn't expand to be larger than the plain text. But integrity has always been a bit of a challenge by comparison, because you usually store message authentication codes, some ways of integrity tags that allow you to compare against what you're looking at. And that's been difficult from the standpoint of traditional hard drives. Your options were, try to silently put them into, put these tags into your sectors or store them somewhere else. With the notion of layered storage, it allows us the opportunity to potentially, leverage these burst buffers or other non-volatile memory in the system as a means for storing integrity information, such that it can be quickly captured, quickly processed. Now, when you're actually reading data, the important thing is that every time you write integrity metadata tags, you're adding to storage, and it's clear that storage is a scarce resource, especially when we're talking about high-speed non-volatile memory. So the important thing is to try to amortize the cost of over the length of storage by trying to do as much as possible over sets of data. So this is where understanding workloads and properties of individual file systems comes in handy. So what I've sort of proposed here is based on some work that I've done in the past looking at iSCSI, where we were able to leverage mechanisms to do what we called lazy decryption, lazy authentication, based on elements of that particular protocol. So by understanding that how the protocol actually works and where encryption is necessary and when decryption is necessary when it comes to particular operations or particular use of data, we can delay that until it's necessary and gain from a performance standpoint. And the same is true with authentication. So I think being able to trade as many expensive public key operations for symmetric key operations, especially if these processors in these HPC environments support hardware crypto acceleration, such as AES and MI instructions, that'd be a good thing. And also tuning the workloads to if we know, for example, that we're always going to be looking at not just single objects, but groups of objects at a time, then we can amortize integrity operations over those and reduce the amount of storage and in processing. One thing that I didn't mention in here, but I noticed reading about the I/O middleware section in that in the workshop proposal, is the idea that there is this notion that you can that folks have looked at dedicating cores of to do operations in the middleware, and that seems like something that could be easily feasible as well with security. If we if dedicated cores in are performing security type operations in security management, then that's a way of ensuring that we can keep a near line performance on I/O intensive operations. So that's sort of what I would propose is this the notion of how do we leverage the underlying non-volatile buffers to provide security while maintaining performance, and how to characterize workloads in such a way that we offer maximal security. And as was mentioned, I thought Raju's point earlier about that there's information you might not want to cache because you access it so rarely that putting it into the cache is potentially harmful to your overall throughput. I think the same could be true of security. If we have an understanding, now usually you don't lose all that much when it comes to different bit lengths of security, but it could be that if we're looking to rapidly access certain types of data, that we might consider encryption mechanisms for them in a different manner than data that's accessed less frequently or that we're less concerned about. So being able to characterize that at the from the file system level would be an interesting thing.
Okay, thanks. So I'd like to ask Jay a question, because in the solicitation, the mentioning of security is quite brief. Only says about how security can be managed for better use the I/O middleware. So what is your take on this? And how do you think about what Kevin just described? Is that relevant?
I think it may actually be pretty serious overkill for the environment. In general, we've always defaulted back to usually POSIX security for different things, or if it was a classification problem, then there's generally either dedicated system time or some other air gap that prevents other people from having access at the same time. This might be a way to argue for some additional utilization during times when you need to have more security. I'm not exactly sure how to think about it, though.
Yeah, so this was kind of a question that I had. Again, looking at this, it seems as though HPC in general assumes a highly trusted environment. So, what are the concerns that folks have who are actually running these systems? Are they concerned about malware, or do they assume that they're air gapped away and that you don't have to worry about? Are they concerned about the insider threat, or not so much?
Malware, pretty much not at all, because either it's a one-way pipe in, and you have to be staged manually through multiple layers to get out, or the number of layers that you have to go through to get out is more than any existing malware would have to deal with. So to get from the compute node to the outside world, you have to go from the compute node to either a login or a service node, and then from there you can get to the outside world. Mm-hmm. So that extra step of indirection will cut off pretty much all the malware that exists, unless it's specifically written for the environment. And the assumption is that that's just not a priority.
Mm-hmm.
Insider threats also not something that's really considered that much. They, at least for Sandia, the focus is more on personnel monitoring and other activity monitoring rather than trying to do something in the secured computing environment.
Mm-hmm.
The other places that I know where this comes up is for general use HPC machines. Private companies can rent time on the machines, for example. And when they do that, they may have some privacy that they want to ensure. So, for example, just knowing who the user is and how big the job they're running is may give a competitor information about what they're doing. So there's some security requirements there, and then you absolutely want to make sure that you protect the data to keep it from being snooped on by other users.
Mm-hmm. Right. So Jay, I think what you're talking about is that there are some, what are these things called, like side channel information leakage, potential for sites,
yeah.
and maybe even... Because what you're saying is that malicious activity within the HPC cluster is unlikely, but at the same time, you want to make sure that application behavior is isolated and non-visible to co-located applications on the same HPC machine, right?
Right.
So you're saying that the problem is maybe not as difficult as the general enterprise security problem, but at the same time...
It's nowhere near as difficult as the general enterprise security problem.
Right, because you have the whole malware-related questions there. So, but it's, I mean, at the same time, the proposal did spend, I think, a page or more talking about security related concerns, and the fact that they included it in the call for proposals makes me believe that any proposal for addressing those questions would be valuable for to have. And one thing which I see here,
let me give you an example
of
what I could think of that would make sense. At least to me, and that is that maybe you have a general key value store, and for performance reasons, you want to make sure that the interface to it is as thin as possible, and instead you use public and private keys to encrypt all the objects. So that way anybody can retrieve any object, but only decrypt it if they have the magic key.
Mm-hmm.
And that would be assuming you have the hardware acceleration for that, a pretty straightforward way to have a general use service that was also secured. So we'd be looking at how to build the infrastructure to support that kind of thing and what the overheads would be.
Right. So you're talking about a specific interface, which is key value or maybe object based interface
right.
that applications would use, but not... more fine-grained than that. For instance, you could also think about using file-level or checkpoint granularity keys so that only checkpoints are only visible to those who have decryption keys.
That kind of thing would be useful as well. I just gave that as an example.
Mm-hmm.
The idea is that right now, the assumption on the key value stores that I know of that people are working with in HPC, there is no security at all. So the POSIX, even the POSIX level security that we used to take advantage of, or even really still continue to take advantage of, there's no analog for that in the key value space. And that's probably something that we need.
Mm.
Right. And so in the solicitation, so this is only one sentence, right? So how security can be managed for multi-user IO middleware? How do you interpret this?
I would say it's probably on that front right there, is that assuming you don't have POSIX, how do we add back in that security envelope for other sorts of storage mechanisms?
Mm.
Right. Okay. So that was interesting that you mentioned this notion of sort of co-location of services. So to what degree does this look like sort of general cloud computing platforms. Because I've done some work looking at side channels and clouds and finding ways of achieving co-residence on machines or figuring out how to profile other users' workloads. Is that something that do folks have HPC clusters that are generally available for multiple companies to run things on? Does it look then kind of like a cloud type environment?
Sandia does not. The Open Science Labs do. Mm-hmm. Like, I know that both Oak Ridge and Argonne's, anybody can request time as long as they can justify the need and the use for the machine.
Right.
And in that environment, I have not dug through very much on the way on the cloud front to see how much privacy is or about what jobs are running. But you basically, from your command line, from your login node, you could say, what's the current status of the machine? It'll give you the list of the jobs, who their user that logged in is, how much time they have left, mm-hmm. and how many nodes they're on. And then it'll also give you the queue of all the things that are queued up to run when space is available.
Right.
So that sort of essentially non-privacy about what's going to run is the general case. So I said that for things where they want something to be more secure or private, they'll generally take the machine offline, kick everybody off, and then run the private stuff, pull the data and everything else off, and then make it available for general use again.
Mm-hmm.
So this may be a way to work around that.
Yeah.
Finally, fear is the number of different places that this impacts. If you look at it from that level, rather than just we want to recreate POSIX security for a key value environment or something like that. POSIX-like mm-hmm. security.
Going for the containers.
Right. Or coming up with a good security mechanism for some other novel storage mechanism that would be of use in this kind of environment.
Sure. Alrighty. This is helpful. I know we used Future Grid for some of the experiments we did with our cloud sidechain. Stuff. So I guess from that standpoint, it's an environment. It's just unclear whether the DOE would be more interested in that sort of thing, or this notion of securing key value storage could be interesting as well.
Yeah.
This notion of multi-user IO middleware in particular, I think, is something I'll try to dig into.
I think that's really what they're intending. We don't have anything right now because we've thrown away POSIX for all of these intermediate kind of storage and access layers.
Right.
Yeah. And just to clarify here, I think, the intermediate layers may not be POSIX and that might create new security questions, but security is always an end-to-end question, right?
Right.
So I think the idea of where data gets created, who is the owner, and how it flows through the system, and it needs to be secured from producer to consumer or wherever it is going to reside, I think does make sense it makes sense to ask those questions, even if you're just focused on this middleware layer which is POSIX free.
Yeah, there's some work on that already. A couple of machine generations ago with Cray, you could, from any node, directly access any part of the RAM of any other node. And with the Gemini network, that was something they stopped. They initially had it completely locked down so that nobody could do that outside of the current job space. But we convinced them that for things like workflows, we really need that kind of capability. So they came up with a protection domain idea. And when an application starts up, you give it the protection domain that you want them to be part of, and then everything that's within that protection domain can access each other.
So there, that level of security is there at least on the non-build-it-yourself clusters. Like with InfiniBand, I would bet that you can, well, I don't know, you have to register memory and such. So there's probably even a level of security there. There's not the, the real random direct access.
Right. So just to clarify, you're talking about secure or security or isolation of memory address spaces as opposed to storage or checkpoints.
Well, that was the networking, and the ability of one node to access another one, and that sort of security. And so that security is there and has been for a couple of generations now. And the file system with POSIX has its layer of security. And there's limitations through the job scheduler about who can kill a particular job or when your job's going to run in the queue. But beyond that, there's really – and that really takes care of most of the end-to-end security requirements. The other things about not being able to see jobs that may have sensitive information, that's handled through taking the machine private. So there's a few gaps, but not many that aren't readily taken care of already.
Right.
So I guess maybe Kevin can think more in terms of isolation because there'll be data objects belonging to different users. So the shared NVM, right? How do we provide the right, I don't know, the interface or mechanisms to support isolation?
Right. And the other piece to consider with that is if you have a few million processes on the machine and they're all each creating some objects, you want to have some way to effectively reduce your search space looking for those objects. And the security envelope might be a natural way to do some partitioning or other sorts of decompositions that will reduce that search space.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Kevin, does this give you enough thought and enough materials?
I think so, yeah.
Okay.
I think, yeah.
Okay, good. So, this meeting is taking pretty long, so let's just wrap it up. So the last two pieces, I think, Jay wrote most of it. Can you explain a little bit, Jay?
Sure. The piece of guidance that we got from Lucy Noel back in December was that the machines post of exascale will be required to handle big data style tasks in addition to traditional HPC workloads. I've heard that refined more recently to be instead of just big data analytics, but to the experimental and observational data. And to me, that's kind of saying largely the same kind of thing. I think there may be some data ingress and egress differences between the two, but the actual processing side of it is probably pretty similar. So what we want to be able to do is figure out how to use these different memory storage devices. So where do we need, how much non-volatile memory do we need and where to be able to support big data analytics, knowing that we have a very limited amount of space or a limited amount of budget space for the machine, for that tier of memory. And like, for example, the Coral machine for Oak Ridge is going to have an 800 gig SSD on every node. And the thing that we're starting to think about is that it may make more sense to have a 256 or even a 512 gig SSD on every node and then a separate 256 or 512 and have a total less amount of capacity, but have that second piece in the compute area so that you don't have to interfere with the node to get access to it. Because the thing that IBM said very proudly was that when they were talking about this recently, that they gave direct access to the SSD from outside, and it did not interfere with the CPU. So I asked them about that. I said, well, what about the network interface and the SSD? They said, well, yeah, you're going to interfere with that and also main memory. So it hits the memory bus and the SSD and the network card to access it from the outside.
And in so many cases, we're really more memory bound than we are CPU bound on these machines, that that's not really a viable mechanism for us to use. So what we want to be able to do is, because these big data analytic workloads tend to be read intensive, we want to figure out how to distribute this storage so that we can support those workloads as well as the things like Checkpoint and other more traditional HPC workflows on these machines. So that's really what these two are kind of looking at.
Okay, so you mentioned data ingress, egress. So I imagine the EOD data, they come from the experiment, right? Come from the telescopes, collider, sort of things.
Right. Yeah.
And they get dumped to the parallel physics. Right?
Well, they get dumped to the machine. They wouldn't get dumped to the parallel file system.
Ah.
That would be the thing. Is they want to dump it directly into the machine and have this machine architecture be capable of doing the massive downsampling necessary to make that storable in the parallel file system,
mm-hmm.
as well as the other sorts of analytics and potentially simulation tasks.
Mm. Okay, that makes sense. Okay, thanks.
Yeah. I think the bigger priority for the more general use machines would be able to support things more like the biology apps that have like they want a petabyte of working space just for the database.
That's like a blast, right? MPI blast, where they would load data from the storage into memory and then be processed, right?
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, and it may just be a whole bunch of data matching kind of problems on it, but the raw database is enormous. And so we have these kinds of notions that we want to be able to support these sorts of applications that we have this huge read and then a memory-intensive, essentially, operation to work on them. And we want to be able to support that kind of workload in addition to the other ones we've been talking about.
Okay. Wait, anybody else has any question?
The other piece I see on that is that most of the other work that we've talked about can be used to feed into that to make a more complete model.
Mm-hmm.
And that would be one thing I'd want to look at is as we're going through figuring out how to use these devices, try to come up with characteristics that we can use to feed into a model to try to figure out how to balance these systems in a way that makes sense.
That's the last class you wrote there, right?
Right,
yes.
Right.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. That's actually, I like it a lot. That's really forward-looking. Because we don't really know how these resources should be distributed.
Right. Yeah, so that's what I was thinking is that from an organizational standpoint, presenting it so that we're looking at as many of these different locations for the non-volatile memory as we can, and then have this overarching piece that says, based on all of that work, we're going to be able to understand how to distribute this. We get the benefit of how to use all of that, but then we also understand how to distribute it in a way that makes our machines the most productive.
Mm-hmm. Roger, you were saying?
Right. So on I had a question on number 7, which is big data analytics. So this is more like the Hadoop style analytics, or you're looking at some other kind of.
Hadoop is certainly a major use case, but not the only one.
Okay. Okay.
So that's the EOD data that Jay mentioned.
Right.
So it's the data that come from the colliders and the telescope, but they have to be processed by the payloads to basically data reduction before they can be stored on the permanent storage.
So there's the in transit variety of analysis or processing.
Well, it's different because
right.
Well, I guess in 2020 we're talking about this simulation, right? The simulation jobs and they generate data and so. But for the EOD data, actually the main just task of the data processing is to downsample the data.
Yeah, or you may be monitoring, say, a fusion reactor, and you need to be able to track and do analysis over time on the sensor readings that you have on different parts of the reactor to figure out when it needs to go into maintenance. Mm-hmm. That's another use case that we're looking at. Mm-hmm. So that would be a machine that you would ideally want to balance between the two, because you're probably going to have this experimental or this observational data coming in, and then want to feed that directly into a more communication-intensive analysis program that's probably running on the same platform.
Got it.
I see. Okay. All right, yeah. So this is more... So the number 7 and number 8, I see them more as, sort of management... of resources for different usages, as well as different application usages and different types of resources. So number 7, I see it as looking at a different class of maybe usages than the conventional HPC, or maybe it's mainstream and. Sufficiently mainstream. I don't know how you see it. Is that a special usage or more mainstream, number 7?
From the lab perspective, it's new. From the industry perspective, it's mainstream. And it's just that we're going to have to start supporting that mainstream view of data analytics on these machines.
I see.
And both this dissertation report, they mentioned the EOD data quite a bit.
Yeah.
Okay. Right. Yeah, so maybe we should wrap up.
Looks good.
Okay. I guess I have almost enough materials for the two-pager. Just using the introduction part, I don't know how much space that's going to take. So the only pending piece is, Jason's piece, see whether we can find anything for him to work on, the microscope. And then I guess Kevin may want to revisit his piece too. Kevin?
Yeah.
Okay. So if you can, please finalize basically number 5 and number 6. Tomorrow, by the end of tomorrow, so that will give me enough time to make changes to the two-pager and a summary on Thursday.
Ready.
Jason, are you there? Are you still there with us? Okay, I talked to him offline then.
Yes, I am.
Okay, thanks. Okay, so just we can talk more offline if you need. If you didn't make any change, please just have it done by the end of tomorrow, and so I can incorporate it in the two-pager on Thursday. And so I have two more questions, logistics questions. One is that, like I said, I think we should start to work on the develop a full proposal. And the timing is will be out of town in a couple of weeks. So. Let's try to get the ballpark of the proposal down, and we have just a little bit more than 1 month before the full proposal deadline, so July, like something. Right. So, I have one question: is that is everybody okay with using LaTeX?
Yes, please.
Cool. And next question is: I would suggest for us to touch base once. Once every week for the next few weeks. Does that sound good to everyone?
I think it's necessary.
Yeah.
Okay. Good.
I agree.
Does this time still work for everyone, or should we choose a different time? I know it may be late for the people in Florida.
It works well for me.
Sure.
It should be fine for me.
So Ming, I just want a quick question. Do you want to include the cache QoS piece? And if so, let me know. And I'll write something up. If not, that's okay. We can save it for the big proposal.
Yeah, I think we can save it for later. Yeah, not for 2 pages. For 2 pages, we have enough materials. At least from our the titles that we did.
All right. Okay.
Sorry,
go ahead, please.
All right. So, if we also everyone, we meet at the same time, so 5 p.m. Eastern time. Next week, Tuesday.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you, everyone. And so we'll meet later.
Just one thing, maybe.
Right.
Question. Sorry. The writing of the big proposal needs to start before we meet next week, right?
Yes. I will have the. So I will create a repository, SVN repository, and create an outline of the proposal. I think in less a couple of days. And then we can start to, so everyone can start to develop your own individual piece. And next Tuesday, we can talk about the outline of the proposal, the structure of the proposal.
Sounds good.
Sounds good.
Bye. Thank you.
Thanks,
talk to you later.
Thanks a lot.
Bye.
Bye.
Thanks.
Bye.
Yeah.